Game on.
GAA.
Now, I am delighted to say that we have author Michael Moynihan in studio to join us to talk about his new book, More Than a Game, the GAA and Where It's Going. Michael, you're so very welcome.
Thanks, Marie.
This seems like a very timely book because there are a lot of things happening both in society and in the GAA. So it's good to have something like this to go to have a look and to get some analysis on where things might be heading. It's essential reading. For you, though, what prompted you to write a book like this?
Well, I think you kind of put your finger on it, the way society and the GAA interact without being too kind of pointy-headed about it. I suppose where it really came from were a couple of questions that kind of kept popping up in conversations I had with people. Basically, what is the GAA for? Is it about elite intercounty sport? Is it about participation and getting kids through the gate? Is it really a property organisation with thousands of premises all over the country? Or is it now a media company providing and content on its own and with other companies? And I suppose what I really wanted to say was, is it one of those things? Is it all of those things? And how do those questions intersect with each other?
Yeah, they're important topics as well, because I suppose with the way society is changing as well, that the GAA needs to change to fit in with it. Did you find the answers to many of these questions, do you feel?
No. Well, in fairness, people were very generous with their time and really engaged with the questions. And there were some really interesting answers. Someone like Tom Ryan, the Director General of the GAA, to be fair, really engaged with. He actually answered the question for himself. He said the GAA has to be about participation, about getting kids in, because the kids are the future and they're the clubs become the counties and so on and so forth. So in that sense, he was willing to answer the question. He was willing to put his name to an answer, that put it that way. The other side of that, though, is, you know, where is the GAA going? Can it just focus on participation? Not really, because the premises have to be in place for the participation. How are the premises put in place? Well, media has something to do with that, because you're monetizing your content without using too much marketing speak in the form of the games. So they're still intersecting. But I think if you have a primary focus, say, participation, that informs everything else then that you do.
You mentioned the media there, and it is quite a complex part of the GAA, and it's probably a complex relationship. And I suppose to read just how poor it is, is the reality that I guess people maybe aren't really aware of. And I think as well, seeing Jim Gavin being interviewed by non-sports people in the last week or so, made me realise just how different the GAA media's approach is to a lot of the stars and the people. But just in terms of that relationship, do you think it's going to get better?
Can I just say that's very delicately put about Jim Gavin's relationship with GAA journalists. I think, as you say, when you're inside the tent and you're part of it and you're complaining, obviously people don't pay any attention to that, because it's just, you know, a sports writer complaining about access to players. But there's a significant issue there, in the sense that, you know, the players sell the games. It's not the managers, it's not the referees, it's not the administrators. And the fact that, for all intents and purposes, footballers and hurlers are kept under lock and key for 99% of the season does the GAA a disservice. It does the general public a disservice, because I have not yet heard a small child say, I'm off out to the garden to imitate the county secretary or the county PRO or one of the managers. They're out to try and imitate some of the players, and I think putting them front and centre with the media would serve the GAA very well, and it would also serve the players very well.
It has to be a concern, though, just given the fact that we don't know the players. And I know that's something that you outline here as well, that we don't get to see them. We look at every other sport and there's TikToks and YouTubes and Instagrams, and they have huge media access, the NFL being one, the NBA, all the big sports really have a much more developed and appreciative relationship, I think, with the media as well.
Yeah, they understand what they're trying to do. And it's ironic that GAA intercounty teams try to depict themselves as being professional in everything, and yet the one time they play the amateur card is with the media. If you were in the NFL, you'd be in the locker room after a game interviewing players. I'm sure most managers would fall down in a weakness if you propose that for the hurling and football teams. Absolutely. But, you know, the argument is always made, well, these guys, rugby and soccer players, are professionals, so that's baked into their duties in their contract. But surely the argument is, if the GAA is in con- competition with professional sports, there's an onus on it to be more proactive in promoting its own sport. And that is in encouraging players to participate in media duties and to spread the gospel of the game. If they're not being paid to play, why are they playing? They're playing for the enjoyment. And surely they would like to spread that enjoyment and encourage others to participate also.
You've brought us nicely along to the very thorny and delicate issue of payment for managers, and also the amateurism as well, and how long it's going to be called an amateur organisation when you do look at all the amount of people that are being paid in it, players aside. How do you see that going?
Well, let's be honest. If you're a doctor or a physiotherapist or a dietitian providing professional services in an above the board, you know, capacity, I don't think anyone has an issue with you being paid for your professional expertise. People have an issue, or should have an issue, or should have more of an issue with the fact that there are millions of euros sloshing around the country in illegal payments to managers who run the circuit. And what was really striking with the book was that every single person I asked about it acknowledged the size of that problem. Nobody kicked back and said, Michael, you're exaggerating there. That's not really an issue. It's a huge problem. And the fact that it's been allowed to fester to the extent that the GAA is now considering trying to legislate for it and legitimise it shows just how deep that problem has taken root. And to me, I would have to say it is the single most pressing threat against the GAA's future.
You do elaborate on that as well, and you have a chapter on it, but it's really hard to look at maybe the past, and even if you look at football clubs like League of Ireland clubs and the way things have gone with them over time, and consider the economy that we have, and who knows what's coming down the track. Do you think that we'll have an economy there that could sustain it at all in the future?
I can't see how an economy, and this popped up actually when I wrote GAA Economics about paying players, and the point I made then was I'm not sure how anyone could propose that with a straight face in an economy where literally banks were closing down. And if anyone actually thinks that you could sustain professional GAA clubs, I would point them not even to the League of Ireland, but to professional rugby, which has four teams, and one of which is regularly threatened with extinction, Connacht. So how people think 32 football and maybe 12 hurling teams could be sustained in counties as small as, say, Leitrim and Louth, with the population base and the economics of that country. Like, by all means, show me the figures. I'd be delighted to have a look at them, but I just don't think they exist.
How did you get people to talk to you, by the way?
Very easily. Just ask them. And some people were a bit nervous about it and didn't want to participate, which is fine. You can't force them. But what I find, to be fair, I know people have an issue sometimes with the conservatism of the GAA, but the likes of Tom Ryan and Peter McKenna have a refreshing attitude in the sense that, well, look, if we can't articulate our vision of where things are and where they're going, then what are we at? And I think maybe if some of the county managers and players who take their lead from more secretive people were to follow their lead, the whole organisation would be in a far better place.
Are you worried about the future of the GAA?
I would be, in so far as I'm not sure how long this can continue, the current situation. I mean, was it last year? Was it over 43 million was declared as inter-county spending? Now, I'm not saying there's 43 million going sloshing around into clubs and counties off the books, but that can't be sustained. And as long as you have that doublethink where you're kind of rubbing along and not enough people, a critical mass of people, aren't annoyed enough to do anything, that is a threat to the GAA. And I think what I would be worried about would be a county board being pulled in by the revenue commissioners, having their real books exposed, and what would happen then to that unit of the GAA, and what would be the implications for the rest of the GAA of that happening.
The facilities, though, and maintaining them, they are expensive. And that brings me onto amalgamation and when that is going to happen. We had the Camogie president, Brian Malloy, in recently, and I put it to him about it potentially costing 500 million. He said that was nonsense. What are your thoughts on it?
See, I think that figure is kind of getting folded in with a general kind of infrastructural redevelopment. Mm-hmm. You know, to be fair, I think it's wrong to say it's going to cost 500 million to put, you know, kind of showers for women in every club in Ireland or whatever. You know, that's not the case, obviously. I think that's where that figure comes from. And it won't be long getting up to 500 million. But I think that's a bit of a misrepresentation. Obviously, if Semple Stadium, to take an obvious example, has to be renovated, that should be done with an eye to making it more accessible to more teams, which is the natural result of integration. But you can't really say, to me, you can't really say, well, you know, the integration piece is what's really driving up the costs. I think Irish building costs are what is driving, are what will drive up that cost.
And do you think it'll get done though? Like, given everything you know about the GAA, and I know it's a timeline that's fast approaching, it's only 2 years' time. Do you think that they're going to get there?
It just strikes me as a little bit optimistic. I mean, I would have thought at this stage you would have had some kind of concrete markers of progress. And so far it seems either to be quite aspirational, or you have the case where the Camogie president is saying that Gerald Burns' comments are nonsense, which is not the kind of messaging you would expect from organisations which are kind of coming closer together. If anything, that looks to me like they're drifting further apart. I don't like, I'd love to see some kind of concrete markers where, look, we've decided this is going to be the management structure, this is going to be the name, this is going to be how we're going to organise fixtures. And that seems to be quite a way off still.
The other thing that always interests me when it comes to the GAA and what it might look like in the future, and again, it's probably looking at other sports in Ireland like athletics and football, and the new Ireland and the role that that the GAA can play in it. Do you see the GAA playing a bigger role?
I think it's funny that I suppose when you're talking about kind of newcomers to Ireland, it's natural that they would gravitate towards sports they're immediately familiar with, like, you know, soccer, maybe rugby to a lesser extent, and athletics and so on. I think the messaging from the GAA probably should be more proactive. I do know when I wrote GAA Economics that one of the contributors pointed out that the Gaelic part of Gaelic Athletic Association in research was found to be a little bit of an obstacle, in the sense that some of the newcomers to the country thought that was some kind of qualification, that you had to be Irish to participate in the sports. Now, I think at this stage that should be well and truly kind of discarded. But certainly, you know, it is, you know, such a community oriented and embedded organisation that you would be hopeful that it would be one of the prime kind of instruments of integrating people into Irish life.
And with rural Ireland changing as well, just in terms of population, is the GAA, and it has been spoken about quite a lot of late, is the GAA under threat in rural Ireland?
I would say there's a lot of institutions under threat in rural Ireland. In terms of, is there going to be a club in every parish to the extent we've always been used to? I'm not so sure, because, you know, you go up and down the West Coast and places aren't actually denuded, but there are so many holiday homes, for instance, that you don't really have a population to pick from. You know, one of the horrifying stats was when I spoke to Pat Spillan, he pointed out an area in South Kerry the size of Louth, which can't field a minor team. Between four or five clubs. Now, you know, the remedy for that is a higher birth rate. But if people, A, aren't living there, and B, by the way, can't get planning permission to build houses, then that has an impact. Now, that's, if you like, an unintended consequence of chaos in the planning system, that GAA clubs are struggling. But I suppose it illustrates how the GAA is embedded in Irish life, but also how developments and changes in Irish life have a huge impact on it.
Pat Spillan says that it's a book to start 1,000 debates. And it definitely is when you go through it, because everybody has differing views on so many things, and you cover them all, really. Is there something that you love talking about?
Look, nothing beats talking about the games themselves. I mean, you know, you can find funding interesting and building facilities, etc. But actually talking about the games and the changes in the games and the future changes in the games. Like when Tom Ryan says, you know, why should it be 15 aside? What if it were 13 aside? You know, that would be hugely interesting, just in terms of how the games would develop tactically in terms of skills, etc. You know, nothing, it's like the GAA itself, nothing beats the games.
GAA Go is another thing that you explore as well. Are we comfortable with it now, do you think?
To be fair, and it's not because of where I'm speaking at the moment, I think RT was kind of unlucky in the sense that it was caught in a wide... GAA Go was part of a wider firestorm, I think is how Declan McBennett referred to it. I think he's right. There were some unfortunate circumstances that kind of weaponized the entire debate. I think a lot of politicians now, looking back, would want to be a little bit embarrassed with the posturing they had about it, because as he rightly points out, it was probably more of a national broadband issue than a national broadcasting issue. But, you know, the fact I think the fact that you had the JNRT on kind of two sides of the one negotiating table was something that couldn't be sustained, and it hasn't been. And in fairness, as Declan said, if everybody knew that Cork Limerick down the park in 2024 was going to be a classic game, he said it'd be great to know all the classic games in advance and we could plan accordingly.
Of course. Michael, it's great. Like, it just gives so much food for thought, and it feels like a really important time to write this book as well. And I hope you'll be doing plenty of follow-ups now over the next few years as well, as we try and navigate and figure out what the future of Gaelic games looks like.
Thanks a million, Marie. Game on. GAA.